Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I am Bob Hill.
Back from Minnesota.
Minnesota A? You have to say A.
A, the great northern woods.
It was just, the weather was perfect. It was in the kind of the high 60s and low 40s, even to 38. Uh-huh. I got to see fall for the first time. Now I'm coming back here, I get to see it again, which is kind of fun. Yeah, a buddy of mine owns a place on a lake up there in the Lake District. Mm-hmm. Had a really good time and energizing. Went to the Minnesota Botanical Gardens and met some great people whom we're going to have on the show here.
And it sounds like you maybe caught a little bit of a cold, too.
I caught a little bit of a cold up there. I guess that's mandatory in the airport.
Maybe it is.
If you're going to Minnesota, A, you have to catch a cold. It comes
and
with
it
the program.
Comes with the air flight.
Yeah, it might be, too.
I think that's what they say.
Taking your shoes off in the airport, maybe. Who knows?
Oh, anyway, well, we're glad you're back, and we look forward to hearing more about your adventures in Minnesota. Today on the show, David Bedford, you visit with him at University of Minnesota's Apple Research Station. 20,000 trees.
Yeah, of which two probably make it into production eventually.
Amazing.
But David had a large hand in the Honeycrisp apple, which is apparently one of the most popular apples in the history of the world. But talk about time. They released the thing in 1974. It was patented, 1974. And it didn't get in the market until
1991.
Right.
Yeah.
So it takes a while to sell these things.
Sure does.
It took 17 years for it to take off.
And I read somewhere that it has been around for 47 years, but it's all those little baby steps to things being propagated and tested and tasted and tested again and tasted.
He will bite 500 to 600 apples a day. And he wanders around among 18,000 apple trees.
Does he bite and spit, or does he swallow?
Actually, he spits, yeah.
I was going to say, you kind of have to. That's a lot of fiber.
It's like watching a baseball game, which drives me nuts. Uh-huh. The whole dugout's full of guys spitting. It's just disgusting, but he does it nicely.
Yeah, it's an apple after all.
Very interesting guy. And he also talked about hardiness things, which I was curious about. And, how that works and how they developed that thing. Although the Honeycrisp is all over the country now, obviously.
That's cool. And then Fred Spicer, he's the one of those classic horticulture names.
Yep.
People.
Perfect, yeah.
Director of Birmingham Botanical Garden. We're going to talk to him today.
Yeah, he was at the Kentucky Nursery and Landscape Association meeting at UDell back in early September. Had a great talk on bringing Alabama to Kentucky, risks, rewards, and caveats. Meaning, of course, that we tend to think plants aren't hardy enough here. There's also plants on the southern extreme that we think it's not warm enough here. Mm-hmm. And he talked about plants you can introduce from Alabama, maybe try them here in the middle. Mm-hmm. So he's interesting. Also, he had a great take on native plants. I want to talk to him about that. You know, this whole native plant war, the native plant purists who only want natives. He discusses what's a native and why it's not necessarily a good thing to only plant natives, especially when the natives disappear.
Yeah.
So, interesting guy. That'll be good. Yeah. A good show, too.
Absolutely. So we hope that you'll stick with us. In the meantime, Bob, what's going on in your garden?
I'm in my bulb planting mode.
Good.
You know, I moved a bunch of rocks in behind my kitchen window earlier in the summer, thinking all along I'd put crocus in there and some little bitty anemones and some other low-growing plants for the spring. So I'm working on that. I'm trying to get different ones and unusual ones and kind of have them come up. And I'm not doing too many daffodils there because I get tired, frankly, of the daffodil leaves hanging around.
And the low thing is nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you can plant around them a lot quicker.
Iris cristata.
Yep.
Tolerates shade, too. Yeah. So
perfect.
That's a good low.
I'll find
extend some
of
those the season
sure.
a little bit.
So that's what I'm doing. I'm doing my kitchen window look. Mm-hmm. How about the wishy
state? It is about that time,
bulb time
to consider bulbs. So we might need to address that here pretty soon coming up on Homegrown, huh? Well, we're having a chicken problem.
Oh, no.
You know how I don't really name my chickens unless something extraordinary happens or they do something extraordinary. I now have a new named chicken.
Uh-oh.
Her name is Pluck.
Oh, no. That can go two different directions as far as I can see here.
That's right. Pluck has been segregated from the flock when they're in the coop.
Darn Pluck.
Because, poor Pluck has been nearly pecked to death by the rest of them.
Why?
Chicken philosophy. I don't quite understand 100%, but my sister had suggested, you know, maybe it's them reacting to her perhaps being sick or weak in some sort of fashion because they hadn't picked on her before, and then all of a sudden they start picking on her. There's all these feathers everywhere, and, you know, then one day, it was a day that they were up in the coop because I wasn't home. They had picked on her so much that there was some blood.
Oh, no.
So I talked to my friend Kay Yunt, who's gave me the chickens. And she said, yeah, it's probably time to protect her because once they draw blood, they may get more aggressive and she could potentially bleed to death. So we keep her protected. You know, I just took some wire and kind of did a corner of the coop. And she loves it in there. It's funny. At night, because I try to get her out during the day if I'm home. Because, you know, if they're outside, she can run away from them.
Yeah.
But if they're in the coop, she can't. She's bait.
But is she lonely?
She seems to be fine. And I think she's my loner chicken anyway. I always had a chicken that was a little bit of a loner.
Yeah.
And she seems content. And it was so funny because when I offered to let her out of her little special area, she was hesitant.
Oh, my.
And then one night, everybody got up on the, you know, the roosting thing.
Yeah.
And she had gone back into her little area and jumped in her box.
You know, humans act the same way, unfortunately.
And they do.
That's the trouble.
They do.
They always find somebody.
They do. To
pick
pluck,
on. Pick on, always.
So we're hoping Pluck, her feathers are growing back. So once her feathers will grow back, we'll try to go back to the normal routine and see what happens. But we figure once her feathers grow back, maybe she won't be so fair.
Well, she quit laying
Pluck
eggs?
Game. Yes, she has, in fact.
That would do it.
Yeah. A little extra stress.
Is there chicken counseling available somewhere?
We will find out.
Okay.
I'm trying to be that. I'm trying to be there for Pluck. So, so is Buck, actually. Buck's trying to be there for Pluck as well. We'll see. All right. There are some things going on around town. Of course, Udell, they've had a couple of these so far, but they're going to have another Garden Geeks class session October 23rd and the 30th. Basically, it's Thursday evenings, four consecutive Thursday evenings, October 23rd, 30th, and then November 6th, 13th. From 6:30 to 8:30, and, you know, the director there, Dr. Paul Capiello, leads it and just, I mean, really gives you lessons and good foundations for being a good plant person. So,
like our financial system, we all need good foundations.
We do indeed. We do indeed. So check that four course series out there at Udell. You can visit our website, of course, at wfpl.org for more information.
And Botanica will present horticulturist and author Paul Touquet for a special presentation on designing a natural landscape, how and why to create the safe yard of your dreams.
Sounds good.
Yeah. He's the author of the Organic Lawn Care Manuals, the best-selling lawn book in the last couple of years. And the event is free for Botanica members, $10 for non-members. So if you want to see this, guys, at 3 p.m. on October 26th. For more information, go to our website.
WFPL.org.
Thank you. I needed that.
Okay. His nose is a little stuffed up, so I'll help him out with when I can tell he's out of air. I'll help you out, Bob, okay?
I'll be horizontal here.
I don't want you to pass out. No. So time for some additional inspiration. No hot air here by any means, but Fred Spicer is joining us now.
Yeah, Fred is the executive director of the Birmingham, Alabama Botanical Gardens. His background is in landscape horticulture, garden design, and public garden management, all of which gives him a broad view of the plants which work best in which areas, either Alabama or Kentucky, domestic as well as native. Fred will tell us all about it. Welcome to Homegrown.
Nice to be here, Bob.
Yeah, a lot of Kentuckians head south to Florida, and tell them what they'll find when they come to the Birmingham Botanical Gardens. Do you have anything special you have, or is it kind of a year-round display, or what?
Well, because our soil never freezes, Bob, we really do have a year-round display. And, of course, we're far enough south that things like camellias, both the fall-blooming Sasanqua camellias and the Camellia japonicas that bloom in the winter, are perfectly hardy. And we can grow a lot of tropical things also, especially things that winter over in a bulb or a big rhizome in their roots, and they kind of avoid winter kill if the rhizomes or the bulbous roots don't freeze. But, you know, we're also well known for our extensive native plant collections. And Alabama has the fifth highest total biodiversity of any state in the nation and the ninth highest biodiversity in plants. So we have a really good representation of things like trilliums and native deciduous azaleas.
So the last visit you made to Kentucky was to talk about, you know, issues of hardiness, things that would actually work in Kentucky that come from Alabama. After we talk about all these, your nice warm soils that we don't always enjoy in the wintertime. So let's talk about some of those issues when we look at trying to bring plants up from the south and working them into our own gardens up here.
I mean, I think primarily there's a lot of opportunity. or Kentucky gardeners. But like anything else, you have to start with the dirt. What kind of soil do you have? And in many parts of Kentucky, as in some parts of Alabama, limestone soil can be very limiting. When you start talking about growing things like deciduous native azaleas, they're really, most of them are not going to be happy in those limey soils. Now, there is a new species recently described from South Carolina, the Maywhite azalea, that has been found on soils that are closer to neutral. Now, they're not high alkaline soils, but so the possibility does exist maybe with that species to sort of, you know, play around a little bit. And certainly there's a wide range of plants, you know, that are not necessarily native plants that are very, very adaptable to climates as warm as Birmingham and climates as cool or as relatively cool as Louisville.
Yeah, you know, one plant I like, and we'll talk about more specifics later, but I've seen it in Georgia and Alabama, is the lauropetalum, which may be so, probably so popular down there, maybe a weed by now, but I just love the lauropetalum, the color and the leaf color.
Yeah.
Is it possible they're working on a more hardy, northern hardy?
Well, I think a hardy, a truly winter hardy lauropetalum, I think has so far eluded most breeders. And from my understanding, the plant's native habitat in Asia is fairly limited. In other words, it's not like we just haven't gone into cold enough areas as plant explorers and have found, you know, the one that's native to a much colder climate so we can introduce it to colder climates around the world. I don't believe that, or at least the plant so far has not been found in colder climates. So it's really a chance breeding that may lead us to find one that has, or chance selection that has a degree of winter hardiness. Now, that's not to say that you couldn't plant a lauropetalum in your garden in a very protected location.
Right.
And the next 5, 7, 9 years, you have the right kind of winters to keep that plant alive.
Yeah, another sort of esoteric plant, especially for us up here, and I don't usually do esoteric a lot, but I was in Alabama, and it was a croton, Alabama crotonensis, which is a beautiful silver-backed shrub that survived here 4 or 5 years.
I have a beautiful specimen at my house
really? That
is probably 3 feet wide now.
Yeah.
You know, it's east-facing, but protected from all the other sides.
Sounds like a great location.
And it's happy. We haven't had any hardcore winter since it's been there, but...
Well, I know the plant is endemic, meaning it's only found in a few sites in Alabama.
Right.
Huh. And where I've seen those sites, and it's extraordinarily, I mean, you talk about tough sites, solid limestone, very thin soils, full sun, and sometimes very deep shade, and extreme drought. And I've seen the plant thriving really as far north as near Wilmington, Delaware, at the Mount Cuba Center. So I'm not surprised that, you know, in the right location in Kentucky, that the plant would have good hardiness.
Okay, we'll touch on a couple other maybe shrubs and trees that we tend to think of as southern that you might think Kentuckians ought to try.
Well, we have a wonderful small tree called the Trident Maple.
Right.
And it gets very extensive use in the South because it has just incredible heat tolerance. And, you know, I first learned the plant in New Jersey. I've seen it in New York, so its hardiness is without question. But I think you see that plant in the South much more so than you see it in the North. And I don't know why that is. I mean, you may just have, it might be other trees that you have more opportunities with. And another plant we have right now that is at peak from last week to this week, and usually through the month of October, is the American Beautyberry.
Oh, yeah.
And
Calicarpa
Americana. Yeah.
Okay. Right.
And it has the largest fruit of any of the Calicarpa, and probably the largest size and the largest leaf. So, you know, its nativity, it only really goes up right to the southern tier of Tennessee, but it is a, I think, very adaptable much further north.
Yeah, it does. Now, let me switch gears a bit, because you had a wonderful take on this whole native plant, native tree argument. Can you kind of reiterate your feelings on that subject?
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is, if you're selecting plants for a particular garden or a particular landscape, you're limited by climate and you're limited by microclimate. what's the soil, what's the hardiness zone, how much wind is there, and you need to select plants that will thrive in the locations that you plant them. So the concept of saying that there's a native plant for every niche, you know, that's a hard concept to get past, and you may not have precisely, you know, a lot of our urban niches, the list of native plants that you can use is a very narrow list.
Right.
But by the same token, you look at plants that are non-native, you have to have the right kind of place for those also. I mean, there are plenty of really esoteric woodland perennials that, you know, from Asia that are not going to thrive just anywhere. And then I think you have to overlay that whole concept with what the plant provides aesthetically. Is the plant, as Paul Capiello says, a good garden citizen? Is it not going to become an invasive exotic or add to the decline of native ecosystems if it escapes? So I think it's not as simple as saying, you know, all natives are good, all exotics are bad, or vice versa. I mean, a lot of native plants work in a number of different places. They some are generalists and can thrive over a wide range of environmental conditions. Many are specialists. And all plants are native somewhere. All non-hybridized
right.
plants are native
exactly.
somewhere.
Right. Yeah.
So you really have to pick and choose. But, you know, I think one of the things that we don't talk about enough is that native plants give you a sense of place. I, for one, decry the homogenization of the American landscape, where it doesn't matter if I go through a suburb in New Jersey or Maryland or through any of these sort of highway conglomerations of chain stores, you know, there's nothing unique about that. There's nothing experiential about being in New Jersey or Maryland or Kentucky or right. Alabama or Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if we erase the native plant palette, it's one of the few things that really indicates a sense of place.
Exactly. Fred, thank you very much. I sure enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you, Fred.
It's been a real pleasure. Take care.
Fred Spicer is Executive Director of the Birmingham Botanical Gardens. For more information on Fred or the gardens, visit our homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, Bob's adventure in the far north with University of Minnesota apple researcher David Bedford. If you've tasted a Honeycrisp apple, he's one of the people you should thank. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill. One of my father's favorite expressions was, "How about them apples?" And I'm about to find out more about that expression, and a great place to find out. I'm with David S. Bedford. He's a research scientist in apple breeding and cultivar development at the University of Minnesota's Horticulture Research Center in Excelsior, Minnesota, which is about 30 miles southeast of the Twin Cities. It's a beautiful sunny day up here. Everything's green and clean and just great plants, and the apples are looking good. And we're going to talk to Dave about cold hardiness and about apples. So, Dave Bedford, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Okay, let's talk about this hardiness issue first, and we'll get back into apples a little bit, because I'm always intrigued about why plants can survive cold and some can't. Why can't you grow palm trees in northern Minnesota and vice versa, I guess. So talk about what makes a plant vulnerable to cold.
Well, it of course, it's all based on evolution, and plants that have evolved in those warmer climates don't need these extra mechanisms. But there's several mechanisms that make a plant able to withstand super cold temperatures. And basically, it has to do with how the plant deals with the water that is in the cells. And if it really makes no provision for freezing that's coming, then the water in the cells freeze, and that's the end of the cell. Where plants in the north learn to move their water, or have evolved to move their water sometimes between the cells, sometimes the water may have more solutes in it and not freeze at the same temperature. So there's various mechanisms, but it all revolves around the freezability of the water in the plant.
Okay, let's focus on your apple research here. When did it begin, and why did it begin?
Well, it actually began 100 years ago, so 1908. Actually, it began before that. I'd have to say it was about 20 to 30 years before that, but in its present form, at the present location, it was 100 years ago. And basically, it began because of a local breeder who was not a university breeder. His name was Peter Gideon, and he developed, through selecting seeds that were sent to him, what we call the wealthy apple. And the wealthy apple is still grown in this area somewhat. It's not the easiest apple to grow, but it's still a good quality apple for cooking and eating. And that was a real breakthrough in its time. It was a good quality apple that could handle our winters. And at that point, the Minnesota Horticultural Society said, look, it can be done. We just need some money to do it. And they went to the state legislature with wealthy in hand and got some money to get our program started 100 years ago. And really, since then, it has been successful. We've introduced over 100 different varieties of fruits that are hardy in the upper Midwest here, and 27 of those varieties are apples.
Now, would some of these apples work in Indiana and Kentucky?
Most definitely, yeah. Most of our varieties will grow further south. And in fact, the only limitation really is how far south before apples themselves don't grow well. I mean, the biggest factor probably is summer temperatures, but also winter temperatures. Apples are temperate crop, so they do need freeze and thaw periods in the winter. They have to go through a dormancy. So when you get too far south and that doesn't happen, then the plant doesn't grow that well the following spring, and that's really the limitation. The other limitation is just that more northern varieties may not be quite as well suited to hot summer conditions. Now, they usually grow, but you may not get the same color, and in some cases, not the same flavors.
Okay, then take me through kind of this apple research. What does it take to get a bigger, better, if you want bigger, better apples?
Well, I can tell you, first of all, it starts with the breeding. Each spring, we take pollen from several different parents and put those onto the flowers of other parents. We've sort of researched and made sure that we're getting good combination of genetics crossed there. And that results in about 3,000 seeds every year that would be hybrid seeds, basically. And that means that half of their genetics come from one parent, half from another. And those seeds are then planted out. We go through another process of grafting those seeds onto dwarf rootstocks so that they come into bearing a little sooner. The next step is when those trees start to come into bearing in 5 to 8 years, part of my job is to go through all of those trees, and we have about 18,000 of them right now, try to get through each of those trees every week and look to see which ones are ripe and taste them. And basically, by tasting them, we find out which ones are worthy of going on and which ones need to be thrown away. And I can tell you, over the course of the summer, we do that each week, so we're tasting hundreds of thousands of apples. Have to do about 500 to 600 tastings a day. So it does get a little long some days, and I love apples, but I can tell you, after the first 300 or 400, sometimes it's not as much fun. But each year we throw away about 3,000 of those trees that don't make the grade, and we find about 15 that are worth going on for further testing.
Are you looking just for cold hardiness then, or taste, or size, or shipability, or what all are you looking for?
All of those things. We can never ignore cold hardiness because Mother Nature is a cruel taskmaster if you forget that. But really, with our breeding, we're pretty much past that as being the dominant factor. We have enough good cold hardy germplasm that we rarely have non-hardy material. So after that, the two most important criteria that I look for are texture and flavor in the apple. And appearance is important, but I always say if appearance is so important to you, that's what wax apples were made for. Real apples were meant for eating, and eating is all about texture and flavor to us.
Now, then who's your market? Do apple growers across the Midwest, the South, the both coasts, are they contacting Minnesota? Is anybody else doing this kind of research except you guys?
Well, our market, we look at it as a global market, and that might sound a little pretentious because not all of our varieties would be good enough to be global, but certainly our Honeycrisp has received a lot of attention around the world, And then we have some other newer varieties like Zestar and Snow Sweet, which are tending to be more regional, and that's fine. But really, our market is the consumer. That's really who we look at ultimately that we're doing the breeding for.
Well, this sounds like the knockout rose of the apple business, Honeycrisp. Tell us why it's so great and a little bit of the personal history of that particular tree.
Well, it is. I mean, and we're just thrilled by it. It's been sort of a revolution in the apple world, the commercial apple world for sure. And what sets it apart from all other apples that I've tasted as a breeder for 30 years is the crispness. It sort of redefines the term crisp. You know, originally we used to use the term crisp, dense, hard, all interchangeably. And that was to be in contrast with soft and mealy. So everybody likes a hard, crisp, dense apple. But when we came across Honeycrisp, we really had to sort of use that term a little differently. And that really became crisp, and the rest became hard and dense or soft and mealy. And it really has to do with the cell structure in Honeycrisp. The cells in Honeycrisp are about twice as large as other apple cells. And so when you bite into that, it's not a hard apple in the sense that your teeth have trouble penetrating it, but it's a crisp apple, and which means that when you bite into it and pull the apple away from your mouth, it just explodes and very juicy. And you almost have to eat it like a ripe peach sometimes because it's so juicy.
I hope you got some here because my mouth's watering.
Yeah, we'll definitely give you a taste of that and see what you think. Some people have compared the texture almost to watermelon. It's certainly harder than a watermelon, but just that sensation of being loaded with juice and not so hard but more crisp.
And Dave, one last thing. You mentioned other plants besides the apple you're working on for cold hardiness that might at some point work their way south. What are some of those?
Well, we've actually also have a fairly extensive grape breeding program, and that's primarily for wine. And then if we're going back 100 years, we've introduced varieties of strawberries, raspberries, blueberries, plums, apricots, tart cherries, let's see, a few other bush currants and gooseberries. I'm sure I'm missing something in there, but it's about 15 to 17 different forms of hardy woody plants.
I'll have to try those too. And Dave Bedford, thank you for your time. It's really been fun.
Oh, my pleasure.
Dave Bedford is a research scientist at the Horticultural Research Center at the University of Minnesota. For more information on Dave or his apples or the center, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we speak with Lee Squires about storm damage at Cave Hill and another chapter in Bob's fabulous plant stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill here.
Yes, from the Honeycrisp and fabulous apples.
There's actually a newer one coming on, too. I can't tell you about it, but we got to taste it.
Was he going to have to shoot you if...
He gave us a little bag of them. We ate them all the way home.
You didn't save one for me?
No.
Well, from a happy note to a more sad note, we're going to... But last week and this week, we wanted to touch base with some folks about... storm damage
from big wind.
The Hurricane Ike winds, and we have our friend Lee Squires on the line today, who is the superintendent at Louisville's Cave Hill Cemetery.
Well, Lee, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you, Bob.
Jane. I know we sort of realize that Cave Hill's a local, if not national, treasure with incredible trees and monuments. Kind of give our listeners an overview of what's out there, then we'll touch on the storm damage.
Well, of course, we have trees that date back 160 years, something like that, so they're very large. And, of course, right along with that are Victorian monuments, mostly Italian marble, that were carved 160, 140, 50, 30 years ago, right under these huge trees. And that can create a problem when you have a windstorm.
How many acres are we talking about in terms of Cave Hill?
Yeah, Cave Hill is just a little under 300 acres.
Okay, it's bigger than I thought.
And then how many stones or monuments do you know are people buried out there?
Well, we've got 130,000 burials, and I'd say upright monuments, there's probably 80,000 approximately of upright monuments. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How many big trees did you lose in monuments, if you know?
Yeah, we lost right at 80 trees. Around 50 complete trees are on the ground.
Oh, man.
And around 30 trees, you know, were broken in half, halfway up or so, and maybe half of the top is on the ground and the other half is still standing. And so we'll have to take those out, too, just because of the danger in the future. So probably 80 trees will have to come down.
So, Lee, of those 80 trees, are the majority of them significantly older trees?
Most of those are. Yeah. Say 2-foot trunk diameter and larger. Probably the largest was a white ash. It had about a 30-inch trunk diameter.
Mm-hmm. Oh. So were there any in there that you guys were particularly proud of, or just that you had a really strong connection to because you've been out at Cave Hill taking care of these trees for 30-some-odd years? I'm sure you have an attachment to some of them.
Oh, yeah. There was a European larch right next to the rustic shelter house, and it was planted right after the building was built in 1882. So it was probably the prettiest European larch that we had. And it broke off at about 2 feet above ground. And luckily, it fell opposite of the building and didn't fall on the building.
Mm-hmm.
But I hated to see that tree go. That was an excellent specimen.
Well, how do you even begin to clean up? What's priorities in something like that?
Well, we have 16 miles of roads, and of course, we closed the cemetery on Sunday during the storm, and coming Monday, and every road was blocked with limbs or leaves, debris, whole trees, whatever. So the first thing we did was cut the large trees and trunks and limbs out of the roadway. As soon as we did that, then we went through with a large blower and blew the debris off the road, and then we just started going really from down really the main road first and then section to section where we had funerals the next day and cleared pathways to those funerals.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I mean, death goes on, so to speak.
Yeah, no
oh, yeah. Yeah. So we never missed a day of making a burial. And
wow.
On that Monday, believe it or not, we had 6 funerals.
But how about monument repair? How do you replace those?
Yeah, a lot of these that were broken were the Italian marble, and a few of the statues were arms were broken off, the wings,
mm-hmm.
some of the columns were broken in half. But we have very good epoxies and stainless steel rods and so forth that we can put these back together with. And we have a couple monument restoration people on our staff that are real good.
Well, Lee, we're all pulling for you out here, and obviously Cave Hill is a joy to all of us, and hope to see it back to what it was someday.
Yeah, thank you very much, and we're working on it every day, and we'll eventually have it back to looking pretty good here.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you all.
Lee Squires is the superintendent of Louisville's Cave Hill Cemetery. It is another chapter in Bob's plant stories.
It is.
What do you have for us today, Bob?
One of your fall favorites, kiddo.
All right.
Solidago.
Yay.
Yes, it is. I love it too.
Fireworks is my favorite.
Yep. It's called Goldenrod.
Goldenrod.
It's often confused with ragweed. It's got real bad PR, which is actually ambrosia. Isn't that a great name for a lousy plant like ragweed?
Yep.
That's what it's confused with, ragweed. So it hasn't been used much in America until the last 20 years or so. But it's very common across all of North America. There's 130
There's a bajillion different
species.
Varieties, yeah.
Hard to tell apart.
Uh-huh.
Again, long used in England, only recently here in the States. My favorite, as yours, is Fireworks.
Mm-hmm.
We call it Thunder Over Utica. It's got this
beautiful
exploding flower look to it. It's a great companion plant to the beautyberry, the purpleberries, and the mm-hmm. Lespedeza, and the asters, and the mums. It ought to be in every yard in North America in the fall. Fireworks, I love it. And there's a shorter one called Golden Fleece.
Right, but Fireworks is far superior in my
experience. Yeah, I don't like Golden Fleece
as
much at all. There's also Golden Baby, Golden Spangles, and Golden Wings, but enough of that. Here's the fun part. Solidago is from the Latin solidare, meaning to make solid or to join.
Huh.
because of its reputed healing properties 1,000 years ago.
Wow.
It makes you better.
Yeah.
It makes you solid.
Makes you solid. Makes you whole again.
It's also the state flower of Nebraska, mm-hmm. Alabama, South Carolina, and Kentucky.
That's right.
Did you know that?
I did know that.
You thought it'd be big and blue, but mm-hmm. it's not. It's,
no, good grief. That'd be depressing.
It's the state herb of Delaware,
mm-hmm.
and it's got a lot of history connected to it. In the Midwest, I remember this as a kid, when it opened up, it was time to go back to school.
Ah, right.
In the old days, it was used in medicine as a kidney tonic mm-hmm. to fight inflammation and kidney stones and to clean out the kidneys and bladder. Here's the amazing thing. I had no idea. Inventor Thomas Edison experimented with goldenrod to produce rubber, which it contains naturally. He developed a 12-foot goldenrod plant that was 12% rubber.
What, to make like teeny tiny toy tires or
big
something?
Big tires. Continuing that trend. Uh-huh. He gave his buddy Henry Ford, they have a state side by side in Florida, I've been there. Uh-huh. He gave his buddy Henry Ford a Model T with rubber tires made of goldenrod.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing.
And then they turned the experiment
Some
over...
smart people.
Yeah, and they turned the whole goldenrod thing over to the government to test it.
And they dropped
didn't do
the ball.
Anything.
Yeah.
They didn't do anything.
That first mistake.
Yeah. On the animal front, it's used as a plant food by the larvae of various Lepidoptera species.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Butterflies.
The butterflies force the plant to create galls in defense. The larva feeds on the gall, and insects lay eggs inside the gall. Stage three... The woodpeckers come along, peck open the galls, and eat the insects.
Don't you just love it?
Yeah. Nature. Symbiotic all over again.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's a poem.
There's got to be a poem.
There's a poem. From California to Old Cape Cod, lives and breathes the goldenrod, filling every niche and need, and no, it's not ragweed. Solidago comes from better stock. It's Mother Nature's all-around dock. Keep it handy for internal fires, and would you believe it, rubber tires. It's golden colors in the fall run merry among asters, mums, and beautyberry. So plant it now, don't waste an hour. It is, after all, your Kentucky flower.
Very nice.
The goldenrod.
The goldenrod, and it is a fabulous plant. Thank you, Bob.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, the garlic harvest is on.
Homegrown is produced by the apple-loving Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.